You're listening to Rendezvous with the Writer with Bobby Jean and Jim Bell, only on LA Talk Radio.
Welcome to Rendezvous with a Writer, where readers and writers meet.
And story
is everything. We're your hosts, Jim and Bobby Bell.
And we want to take a quick message to send out to last week's special guest host, Tom Swearingen, and his guest, Claudia Nygaard. We thank them for filling in for us last week, and we are back. That was the Hot Texas Swing Band opening tonight's show with their song, Hot Texas. So, Jim, who are our special guests tonight?
Our guests tonight, Sue Bozio and Mayor Pearl.
And there they are. Hello, hello.
Hi.
So they are Albuquerque almost neighbors. Hey, neighbors.
Almost.
Last week, we were a little tied up with Balloon Fiesta. What about you both? Did you go to any? Did you see anything?
You know, I think it's something that everyone should do at least once. But getting up at 3 a.m. and bundling up and going out in the dark.
Sacrifice.
I'll have to let a few more years go by before
I've done
I do
it
that.
Once. That's amazing.
And you've done it once, Mayor?
Amazing.
Well, we did it on the Sunday of the opening weekend. And yes, we got up and did park and ride. We were over there by 5 o'clock. And, it is just such an amazing event. What about the solar eclipse? We had that also.
Amazing. It brought my whole neighborhood out into their front yards and we're passing the glasses around. It was phenomenal.
Yeah.
And all of a sudden I noticed it was like somebody turned off a light and I'd forgotten all about it. So I went, going on? And we went out with a little piece of paper and a pinhole and a back of a book. And we went, yeah, that's a solar eclipse. All right.
Yeah. To our listeners and watchers who don't know, Albuquerque was one of the key places to watch a ring of fire solar eclipse last Saturday, which meant that it didn't totally cover the sun. There was a ring of light around the moon and it cast beautiful shadows.
Yes, the shadows were one of the best parts of the whole thing.
Fabulous shadows on the ground, on buildings, you know, all around. So a fun thing in a fun activity in Albuquerque last week. So welcome. Jim has a little something to probably say about you both before we get started. Are you ready?
I'm ready.
Are you ready?
We have a few words about our ladies here. Sue and Mary grew up together as best friends in West Des Moines, Iowa. Sue attended nursing school at Iowa Lutheran, launching her career specializing in pediatrics, child psychiatry, and occupational medicine. Mary studied musical theater in New York City at the American Musical and Dramatic Academy. Eventually, she became a mental health technician working with children and adolescents. Both Sue and Mayor credit their work at the University of New Mexico Children and Adolescent Psychiatry Center as invaluable instruction in their psychodynamic approach to characterization and fiction writing. Mm-hmm. With a history of pairing up to write short stories, they have been writing together since the 1990s. Honing their craft with the support of the Southwest Writers Workshop, their first novel, Sunlight and Shadow, won a fiction prize from Southwest Writers in 2001. Mm-hmm. Glad to have you here.
Thank you.
And tonight we're going to be talking about the brand new novel that just was released sort of at the end of September. How timely to have you with us, called Hungry Shoes. So let's see, how shall we get started? Jim gave a nice little something about each of you, but would you like to tell us a little bit more about yourselves? And I would love to hear about you as young people and how you met and that whole fabulous backstory.
We grew up in the same suburb of Des Moines, Iowa, a little suburb called West Des Moines, in the neighborhood that we were in. And I moved to her smaller neighborhood after, I guess, third, fourth grade. And so I was new to the neighborhood. I had lost all my usual friends at the previous school. And so I'm kind of, oh, my gosh. And I'm walking over to the little grade school that I'm going to be going to fourth grade in, and saw this little dark-haired girl out in her yard that abutted the parking lot of the grade school. And this dog started to come growling and frothing at the mouth.
He was not.
Yes. He was like a scary dog. A shepherd cross. So Mayor ran over and grabbed his collar, saved my life, and we started talking, found out that we were both
Beatle fans,
brand new Beatle fans. It was 1964, and we began to listen to Beatle music together, learned about how John and Paul collaborated in their writing and then in their music, and we thought, well, if they can do it, we can do it, so we started writing things together. We did music, we did art, we did writing. And it was just a click, you know, at age 10 that this person is going to be an important part of my life. And
So you were writing, and I think you shared a really interesting story. And I would love it if you would share it tonight. Sure. I know you know the story. Yeah. So I'm just going to let you share it.
In 1964, 1965, it was 65 by now because we were in fifth grade and we were in the same classroom. And we were seated alphabetically. So I was Overturf, Pearl, and she was Pearl. And that didn't last, though, because we talked and during class constantly. And so we got moved across the room from each other, and that began our writing career because we started writing notes.
And having everybody pass.
And everybody passed.
We sat in an open square.
So one day I got this beautiful new peacock blue fountain pen, and I wrote this beautiful letter to Mayor and folded it up, and it made its way over to her. And then what happened?
Seventh grade by now.
Oh, that's right. It was seventh grade by now. Okay.
So
our
teacher was walking down the aisle toward me saying, give me the letter. I know that you have a note. And I said, no. And he said, give it to me. And he kept walking toward me. And I just stuffed it in my mouth and started chewing it up.
So she has peacock blue ink running down her face, down her neck.
I'm very loyal.
So she protected my deepest, darkest secrets from the teacher.
Well, we also thought back then, gosh, if anybody ever read what we wrote, they put us in a loony bin. That's what we thought back then. So.
You know,
we had wild imaginations.
We were talking. Kids always write notes and pass them through, and then the teacher wants to get their hands on to read the notes, but we've never heard of somebody eating.
No. And today they're probably texting each other. And, you know, you didn't swallow.
It's a James Bond story.
I know. So
it became kind of a duo. And Mare was kind of known as the kind of, she would kind of blurt out things to teachers that sometimes were a little challenging.
I'm the ADD one, okay?
Yeah.
So, you know.
And so I became her defense attorney, and I would help get her out of, you know, suspension, but get her out of trouble, try to smooth things over. Then we also discovered that as long as we made really good grades, we got cut more slack. So
that would be true.
We weren't slackers in that sense.
Right.
We worked hard.
You, you've written at least three other books together, and you want to, there they are. Do you want to just tell us the titles and maybe a little bit about how you got that series started?
Well, when Mare moved out here, we wrote together as teenagers. And then when I went off to nursing school and Mare went off to New York City, it was hard and heartbreaking in a way, because we thought, well, this is growing up. It means, you know, we were childhood friends and now we're
all childish things.
And we're both going to go off and be serious adults now. And I became a nurse and Mare's working in New York. And the night of John Lennon's death, about eight years later after we graduated, that was 72. And then in 1980, of course, we got back in contact the night that John was murdered. Mare found my phone number from my parents, I think, in West Des Moines, and called me at work and told me that John had died. And we talked all night on the phone, got back in touch, began writing letters that became short stories that one would continue. One would start, the other would continue. Yeah. Mail them back and forth until we couldn't get them into an envelope anymore.
And then they kept raising the cost of stamps.
Oh.
This is before computers and emails and all that stuff.
Yeah.
So,
and they still charged for long distance phone calls.
Yes, I remember.
Mm-hmm. So then Mare began to visit out here in New Mexico, and she became enchanted with New Mexico and wanted to live here also. So she moved out in 88, and we were 35 then. We sat around and said, what are we going to do with all this energy we have, you know, this creative drive that we share? And we thought, well, writing, because it doesn't cost, you know, we don't have to have investors. We can just start learning about it. And we did take creative writing classes in high school, and we were encouraged by our writing instructor, whose name was Mary Swenson. And we actually honor her in Hungry Shoes.
Back to Sunlight and Shadow.
Yes, I will. But anyway, Sunlight and Shadow became our first book that should see the light of day. The first one we wrote was just to learn, and we began to educate ourselves about the writing industry, about the craft of writing, attending Southwest Writers conferences, learning how to pitch, learning how to interact with editors and agents and fellow writers and networking and all of that, really taking seriously the important arena of writing and respecting that. Mm-hmm. And so we wrote this trilogy as our love letters to New Mexico. They are about extended families,
the V Hills, and they run a chili farm. And the first one is a bit of a mystery. It talks about cultural issues. All the books that we write is a healing journey for many of the characters. So the first one is a bit of a mystery. The second one has to do with the drought and a healing journey of the same family.
It's called a growing season. And then the last one is Long Night Moon, and that's where we wrap up the story of these two extended families that live adjacent to each other in a fictional village south of Albuquerque.
Do you have a question?
Yeah, what's the famous question I always ask you? Did they grow green chilies or did they grow red chilies?
Red chilies. We're still not in New Mexico. You know, we've only been here about 5 years, so the whole red thing was like...
turn to red.
They leave
just like with bell peppers. You grow green, and then as they mature and ripen, they become red, and the flavor changes.
You have just answered the question we have been wondering about.
It's the official question.
Oh my gosh!
So those three books all garnered a lot of awards that we were very encouraged by, and felt like, you know, we're hitting our stride. We won each one of the books. Won the Tony Hillerman Award for Best Fiction from the Expo Book Awards and Arizona Awards.
Mm-hmm.
And Long Night Moon won the Zia in 2019 from the New Mexico Pen Women.
Mm-hmm.
And the Willa for Growing
Season. Oh, yes. And we were runners-up for the Willa Cather Award from Women Writing the West.
Wow, that's major. So fiction is your calling. That's really your calling. Why is it important... Why is it important for readers to read fiction?
we've done a lot of research about that because we present at writers' conferences. And one time we discussed how reading fiction has been shown to create empathy in the reader. When you read as a child, you start to learn to put yourself in the shoes of the characters, even if it's a little fluffy dog or a bunny or whatever. You're starting to have compassion and empathy for the character. And that's what the magic of reading, I think, is all about, learning how to be in a different world, in a different place. And
point of view.
And if you only have one life to live here as humans, you certainly can expand that by reading about the lives of others, whether they're fictional or nonfiction. I think it's how we humans bond with each other and understand life on Earth.
We're talking with our special guests about their newest book, Hungry Shoes, and this book from page one, if you're a reader, will compel you to get in the shoes of the characters, all of them, including the main two, Grace and Maddie, and we're going to talk more in depth about this book right after this word from Out West Shop's bookshop affiliate page, where you can find all of their books. Stay tuned. Don't go away. We'll be right back. Story is everything. Find a great one on Out West Shop's bookshop. Go to outwestshop.com. Find books and CDs on the menu. Choose Shop Out West on bookshop.org. Browse through featured authors on Rendezvous with a Writer. Explore curated book lists and our featured picks. Add in note cards, calendars, and jigsaw puzzles. One-stop shopping for great gifts. Use the search box to find thousands more titles. Make the switch. Your purchase supports us as independent booksellers. That's our story.
Welcome back. Welcome back to Rendezvous with a Writer with special guests Sue Bozio and Mayor Pearl. And we're talking about, going to talk about, Hungry Shoes.
Mm-hmm. Oh, be still my heart. This is quite a book. right about the time it came out, our local paper, the Albuquerque Journal, wrote a really wonderful article about the book. And you had a couple book signings just on the heels of that. And this is just the first line from the article. Maddie and Grace, the protagonists of the absorbing new novel, Hungry Shoes, are 17 going on 18. They're kind, intelligent, likable, but broken. Maggie and Grace are victims of abuse and neglect. So ladies, tell us the inspiration behind this book and how it got started.
It started probably in 1980 when I began working at the Children and Adolescent Psychiatric Hospital at UNM, the University of New Mexico. I began to work there as an RN and quickly found it was unlike any other setting I had ever heard of or seen in my career as a nurse thus far. This was in 1980, and there was one of the children in my care was from Zuni Pueblo, and another one of the children in the same, we called them cottages, there'd be 8 or 9 kids in each unit that was like a little freestanding cottage, and there were 6 of those. And in the one that I was primarily working in, this little boy began to laugh and point at his friend's shoe, and it was ripped at the sole and kind of created a mouth between the sole and the body of the shoe. And we kept shoe glue in the staff back office area because, you know, the kids often did have shoes that were falling apart. We'd have to glue them back together. Well, he began to laugh and he called it a hungry shoe. And I said, you know, where did you hear that term, or where did that come from? And he said, well, in Zuni, that's what we call it. And so I kind of tucked that away, and I wasn't really sure if he was telling me something he imagined, because he was a kid that had trouble with staying in touch with reality sometimes, or if it was real. And so a few years later, my future husband came to work at the same facility, and he had lived part of his growing up years in Zuni Pueblo. And so I was able to ask him, have you ever heard the term hungry shoes? And he said, oh, yeah, that's when your shoe's falling apart and it creates a mouth. And, you know, the metaphor was just, you know, too much to pass on. But working there, eventually Mayor, when she moved out, also joined the teams there. And we discovered what an amazing place it was, because kids could stay as long as they needed to clinically. Not because an insurance company says, it's been 3 days, your time's up, we're not paying for this anymore, you're out.
Yeah. Or if you can leave the building, you can, you know, you can be discharged.
Right.
You know, basically,
right.
You couldn't take them anywhere because, you know, oh, they can be discharged.
So we wanted to show in this book how it can really be. We did not exaggerate that setting at all. The thing that is non-fictional about it is how the setting was. It's fiction now because of the way mental health care is funded. They can't stay longer than what the insurance companies or whoever's paying for it can manage. And then they're supposed to, you know, go home or wherever and have outpatient support. But the reality is that there's just too many kids who need the help, especially now, for the amount of services that are available.
Not enough outreach.
So we wanted to write a positive story, though. We didn't want to write a nonfiction sort of let's complain. Mm-hmm. Let's show how it can be, how we saw the power of what we call milieu, which just means the environment, so that kids were in the specialized environment with highly trained staff that knew how to have a professional boundary, but still have a therapeutic relationship with children and young people. And, you know, help them learn how to express their feelings in ways that aren't going to get them into trouble, that aren't going to get them kicked out of school.
Some of them have never even in their family had a healthy relationship.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, what that even felt like.
Yeah.
Trust an adult. Or,
and that takes time. It takes time to trust adults when you have a scared little kid taken into this situation, you know. So, you know, we could talk for hours about that, and we won't. But we wanted to show how it could be. We selected characters. Mare wrote Maddie's character. I wrote Grace's. They meet at age 17 as they've each come from the worst moment of their lives, which both of them almost don't survive. And they are roommates in this unit. The only two girls in the cottage, they have five wacky peers in their group that are described. And some of those symptoms and behaviors we did have to use from some of the real kids that we'd worked with over the
right.
years.
We had to.
They were just too, you know, good to pass up. And
are such a conglomerate. When you work, I worked 27 years there. And so there's so many kids, but there's so many kids that are alike and have the same issues. And we were able to kind of make a conglomerate, I think, of
composite. Yeah.
Basically a good population of what comes in.
And we wanted to show the different kinds of therapies. For instance, Grace is struggling to try to remember her mother who died when she was 5 years old. And she has this, she knows that she has some kind of block that she can't remember her mother. From age 5 on to 17, she was at the mercy of her father, Mitch, who dragged her all over the Western United States, just one step ahead of the law sometimes living on the streets. And she, by the time she was 16, she'd had enough. And she becomes kind of a parentified teenager who takes control of her alcoholic father. And finally, she achieves being able to stay in the same school for a whole year. you know, mm-hmm. Rather than being uprooted and moved and moved and moved. So she has stability and friends for the first time. And then the rug gets pulled out from under her and she ends up in the hospital.
And Maddie lived an idyllic life mm-hmm. in the old town. She was the princess, had all of her dad's attention. They made the mother into a hero and a gypsy queen.
Well, the mother was absent.
Absent, yeah, an absent mother at 6 weeks old. Maddie was 6 weeks old. And so she lived this perfect life in fantasy world. And then all of a sudden, when she was about 12, her father pulls the rug out from under her by marrying a woman that Maddie had no idea he was even seeing. So her world changed drastically in an instant, really.
Mm-hmm. So the overall arc of Hungry Shoes shows the summer. It's the summer of 2002 for reasons that support the story, and also because we were going back really more to the early 90s of how milieu therapy was supported and functioned. And so during that summer, they're both in the hospital for 3 months, both of them, about the same amount of time. And interspersed with that present day healing arc are scenes from each of their pasts so that you see what brought them to this mm-hmm. point in their lives. And we wanted to do that with full-blown mm-hmm. scenes rather than just talking, you know, mm-hmm. because it would get pretty boring just to show therapy scene after therapy scene, right?
True. So,
We are all each other's therapists, and we hope we show a lot of that in the book, that the kids, you learn so much from the kids as you do anyone else, or I did when I worked with them.
Mm-hmm. I think when you mentioned earlier about the power of great fiction writing is that the reader develops empathy for the characters. I have to say that that this book absolutely does that, and if you come like I did from a well-adjusted sort of normal, didn't know the world wasn't like in my family. I thought everybody was like in my family.
Yeah,
you know, I've had years of learning. No, that's not how it is with all families. So this for me, you put us right into characters dealing with panic attacks, dealing with memories, fears, all kinds of things that I would say are not things I've necessarily had in my life, and certainly not daily, mm-hmm. certainly not in the making of everyday decisions. Mm-hmm. And just as I shared with readers a couple of weeks ago, that a book that kept me awake at night, so did this one, because I was so into Maddie and Grace's daily life and how they were processing information, how they were trying to make decisions. And at times, you know, if they're having a panic attack, almost felt like, yeah, I am too. Oh, I'm right there with you.
Yeah, you kind of see them kind of start to break down slowly as well.
As the stresses build over the course of their 16th year, pretty much, you know, as the world start crumbling, and you see them try to hang on and survive. And, you know, Maddie decides, I just need to go find my mother.
I don't need to stay here. You know?
She's somewhere in France, probably. Mm-hmm. So I'll go there, you know, mm-hmm. and you have Grace, who's trying so hard to get her memory of her mother, but also to just get through school so that she has a future and a life. And right now it all depends on whether her father can stay sober or not. And
right.
You know, you've written, those two characters are really resourceful ladies. For 15, 16, 17, it's amazing the strength that they have and how they learn to cope. You know, you've written some great characters, and in addition to these, obviously our two favorites here, but how about Mary Swenson?
Yeah,
your old literary
Dr.
teacher.
Dr. Mary Swenson, she's so
Dr. Mary Swenson. You know, she has one point of view scene in the entire book, and it's the prologue. Mm-hmm. And within that scene where we get a glimpse inside of this woman who works tirelessly to help these kids, and she's so dedicated. She's 60 years old. She already could retire. She's got the years in, but she's someone who's not going to give up yet. She sees the starting of the changes in funding and in administration. She knows that this precious milieu therapy that they have going is, you know, under threat, and she's not willing to give up. And that little prologue ends with her acknowledging that her life's work is not really about her. It's about the kids and the stories that bring them to her, mm-hmm. and that she has to learn how to crack the code and find out what's happened to them so that she can so that she can help them, because it's their story, not hers. You turn the page and now we're in the world of the young people. And, you know, we did meet so many kids that were like Maddie and Grace, who were so resilient and strong and had gotten beaten down so many times, figuratively.
We're gifted in school, you know.
There was, just to go back to Dr. Swenson for a moment, there is a scene when we chatted the other night. I had not finished the book, and this scene came up later. And I had, as a reader, I had begun to wonder if these characters, if any of them were kind of dealing with PTSD. And there's a riveting scene with Dr. Swenson and Grace, and they're talking about EMDR, eye movement desensitization and reprocessing, which, of course, I hadn't, you know, wasn't familiar with. But what it, what that scene showed me, because she teaches Grace a kind of a something to do, another thing to do when she's having a panic situation. But I thought, see, you wouldn't get that if you were just there 3 days.
No,
you know, and here's a doctor who's staying on top of, you know, new research that was new at that time. I think it was fairly. So it's just another point about how very critical it is that residents or patients or whatever that right term is to have the length of time needed.
But people fight over money about that.
I know.
You know?
I know.
It's just, I mean, we were saying what it would have been great if, like, St. Jude, we had a hospital just for mental health for children. That was
a whole
free.
Chain of them all across the country.
That's what we need.
I mean, what they do that, the Shriners do it, the St. Jude does it, but not for mental health.
Yeah, see, and that's what we need. Yeah. So I hope there's listeners listening or watching that think to themselves, oh, here's my calling.
Well, it was ours, too.
Yeah, and we also know the different kinds of therapy, because not all kids are verbal enough to have talk therapy. So we had art therapy. We had recreational therapy. We had sexual issues groups for kids that had those problems. We had, we hit them from all different directions and all different ways, and it was so creative. I think that's probably why Mare and I thrived there in those years, because we would have rounds every day with the treatment team, the doctors, the social workers, the teachers, the educational assistants, the nurses, everybody around the kitchen table. And we would talk about each kid and what are you seeing? What are you seeing? You know, and what's working? What isn't? How can we?
And for 6 years, I was Mr. Z's assistant.
You were Mr. Z.
That was the best classroom I have ever worked in.
A lot of these kids have only had failures in school. And finally at CPH, they would go to school with the same 8 or 9 kids that they lived with in their cottage. So you had 6 classrooms for the 6 cottages. And the Brazos kids went to school with the Brazos. And this is the sign that actually, cottage. We were able to use that name because they retired that name and I got the sign out of it. But I think we show how dedicated everybody was, how creative it was, how we pulled from so many different disciplines.
It was like a a family. I mean, for many years, I went in on my day off just to do Halloween paint faces and just have the fun and go to their party. And even if I was off that day, you know, you just wanted to be there for the interaction and the fun, you know.
Well, and for the kids, once they kind of would adjust, they knew there'd be food, you know, they knew a lot of the different elements in their life away from there that were perhaps
and
daily challenges. It's like, oh, I get up and I have a roof over my head and I have light and I have food at
Grace
a certain time. And, you know,
Grace really appreciated that part of it, that she would have safety.
In reality, we would write on a whiteboard every half hour what was going to happen in the
Because kids need predictability.
Predictability.
So every shift, we would write what was going on,
and they knew the cottage schedule even better than some of the staff. They tell them, "We're supposed to have task group now, or it's 10 minutes till dinner."
Well, there's that one scene with Lucas, who is so attentive to just everything that goes on, and he realizes the helicopter,
a lifeguard.
I'm not hearing it. I should have heard it by now. And he's, you know, he's quite has a lot of angst over that. And they deal with it. They understand right away. Jackson understands.
He's hypervigilant, and that was Grace kind of watching him go through this, and she realized, well, we need to find out. And so they call and find out that the helicopter was grounded on a mechanical that day.
Right.
But that the ground buggies had us covered. But because he had this military fantasy also.
That
actually happened. I did call lifeguard. I was Jackson in that situation.
Were you?
Guard and talked to them and had them talk to him, and it calmed him down. And it was a different name and a different kid. We totally fictionalized it.
Sure.
But it, you know, and Grace realized too, you know, that's what I did with Mitch. I could see the clues when I was going to get ripped out of my life and we were going to be on the run again. She could start to see physical changes in how he looked at her, how he behaved. That's what kids do because it's a survival tactic.
You know, and of all the patients you had, and you know, were any of them decided after they, you know, became better and moved on that you influenced them to become nurses themselves, or
yeah.
I actually had a patient. You know, he was almost a teenager. Came back as a nurse. To the same facility.
To work.
Yes.
Several that became nurses, that became teachers. And, you know, the success rate, we can't sit here and pretend it was 100%.
Right. We know.
There were kids that that never did survive all the trauma that had happened to them.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. The to kind of get back to the title, to Hungry Shoes, I, of course, as a reader, I'm always interested in the title. And then as I read, I'm always sort of looking for, okay, is there a clue? Is there a clue? And exactly how you described the Zuni connection and so forth. But, of course, I was also feeling like, all right, we have some characters that are hungry. We have characters that are not just hungry. They're really almost starving. They have so much they can't eat because they're stuffing emotional things. You know, they're starving for love. They're starving for so many different things, and they're on the run. And at least some of these characters, you know, they end up there in the safety, but they're kind of running. And so I really, at first, when I thought, what's this going to be about? Like, okay. but then as the book evolves, like, oh, I get it. It's really, it is the right title for this book. Absolutely.
You know, we went through 30 years of rewrites with this book. Normally our first three, we spent about a year on each time. It'd be like 9 months for a first draft and then 3 more months getting it into good shape. Was our usual routine. And with Hungry Shoes, it actually began as a screenplay.
And we entered it in competitions, and it actually came in the top three in several competitions. It was in the top 50 for the Austin Film Festival, which is
first time of us writing a script.
Yeah, first time. So
we were like,
but you know, we kept evolving the story as time went on, and this version, I feel like we finally did the title and the kids and the place, the amazing place where we worked, finally brought it into the kind of shape we'd wanted in for to share with readers. Mm. So we're just thrilled that UNM Press, University of New Mexico Press, published it. And, you know, we're getting great feedback. We heard today from the music therapist that used to work with us. Hi, Ron. And he had just finished reading it, and he thanked us for putting this out into the world. He said, you nailed it. You brought back so many great memories of what it was like then.
And producers, if you're listening, it would make it great.
Absolutely. Absolutely. We're going to take a very short, one last very short break. And then when we come back, we're going to find out what you got going on now and maybe a writer process question or two. We'll see. Stay tuned. We'll be right back.
Here at the Out West Shop, we're passionate about the American West, the truth and the myth. We're purveyors of fine Western goods. We scout for unique and distinctive apparel, accessories, home decor, and general merchandise that are a reflection of the Western lifestyle. We hunt for unique artisans and craftsmen who are inspired to create decorative art you can wear based on their own love for the story of the West. We round it up and bring it to you. Check out OutWestShop.com when you need anything Western.
And we're back.
We're back. Yeah, to do my little line here. Welcome back to Roger Boone Writer, special guest, Sue Bozio and Vera Pearl.
We've been talking about Hungry Shoes, and you have to read this book. You've got to read this book. It needs to be on your must read. Don't just put it on the list. Go read it.
And then let us know what you think.
Yeah.
Website, BozioandPearl.com. Very easy. BozioandPearl.com. And you can email us, please do. We love hearing from readers.
We have book club questions in the back of the book.
We already book clubs. We already have one book club all lined up.
And so we like to do those. If they want to have a book club and we come to talk about it, we like to do that.
Yeah, those were great questions at the back of the book. They were wonderful questions, yes.
Good, good.
Yeah.
The interaction with readers is the part we really look forward to once the book comes out, you know.
So just to take a moment to just talk a little bit about process. Did any of these characters surprise you? Did they say, no, Sue, don't write me that way? I would never say that.
Characters always do that. I think once you as a writer trust the characters, they will show you the way. And if one of the things we do in our process, when you have two writers, you have to get very detailed about everything. Character, how do they look? We're both writing the same people. How do they sound? How do they speak? What's the physical layout? For continuity, we have to really be careful with that. We assign each other scenes and we go away and do our homework and come back and read aloud to each other, which is vital. And even if you're a solo writer, I really recommend reading your work out loud to yourself or to whoever, the dog, whoever you can get to listen. And you will hear what needs fine tuning. But yeah, characters, sometimes you find yourself wanting them to behave a certain way, and you're right, Jim. They will tell you. It just the scene won't work.
Jeffrey was really hard to write. It was hard.
Mm-hmm. I'm sure. Well, yeah. Good. I'm glad he was hard to. He was hard.
He's a hard person.
He's hard to read. But we needed to.
Yeah.
You know, he was necessary. unfortunately. Yeah. But yes.
You know, in your collaboration process, do you guys ever get mad at each other? No, that character doesn't do that. No, we don't want to go that way.
You know, I think we're so far past that, aren't we?
Yeah, we don't argue. We don't
debate.
Yeah, but even in our friendship, we don't really argue that much. So
I think, you know, we brainstorm so much and talk so much that we'll each make our case, and sometimes maybe she'll have one idea and I'll have an opposite idea, and from that discussion we'll come up with a third way. You know, I mean, that's what collaboration is taking the best from both of us, and sometimes something completely new that neither one of us could have come up with on their own.
The project is always the highest good,
so right,
put our egos aside and try to figure
we have four commandments for collaboration. Thou shalt have commitment, meaning we both have to sign on and be committed. We must have a shared vision. We talk and talk and fill notebooks before we start the actual writing about theme and setting and characters and what's the point, what are we trying to say, and how do we get there?
Psychodynamics.
Right. With each character, we have to build their entire backstory, whether you see it or not. You know, we have to know it. And the third one, thou shalt get thy egos out of thy way. As Mayor says, the good of the project has to come before either of our, egos or feelings about it. And, and then also the fourth one we recommend is clarity of roles. We're always interested in hearing how do other people collaborate. You know, we have our way, and there's other people that do it completely differently. I watched your show with the two writers that collaborated recently. The book, I'm not going to remember the title. I'm sorry.
It's okay.
But it was fascinating hearing how they, as established writers, came together and now do this series about the cattle. It was fascinating to hear that. But in some writing pairs, they divide it up equally. I think we mostly do that. David and Amy Thurlow used to write Western books. She's passed on. But they were a married couple, and she wrote all the dialogue, he wrote the action, you play to your strengths.
I'm just looking at time real quickly. Where can you already did give your website, but give it again. Where can people find you? Yes.
BoggioandPearl.com.
Okay.
We're also each under Facebook under our names.
Under your names. Jim always delves into the book and finds a couple of things that really captured his attention. And do you want to go ahead and share one or both?
You know, there's a lot of things that caught my attention. I thought about, I could read about 15, 20 of them.
He had a lot of post-it notes in the book.
Yeah, a lot of great description. But we got, I got two that I pulled out that I could go ahead and read.
You can only do one.
And the first one is Grace is describing one of the temporary stops that she and her father have. In other words, one of the temporary places they live in. And she says, the kitchen and the living room were combined into one chaotic heap, stacked dishes, encrusted pots and pans, obliterated the sink, countertops, and spilled out onto every available surface. Well-fed cockroaches blazingly held their ground in broad daylight. A television with a rolling picture yammered in the far corner. Mitch's couch held the three kids, who looked in the direction with curiosity.
Such a scene. Oh, my gosh. Such a scene.
That was fun to write, actually.
We are right there. I mean, there's more to that scene, but that gives you the
Grace
picture.
Grace has to roll up her sleeves.
Oh, does she ever.
You know, it got one on Maddie. Maddie was watching TV in the morning. She was getting ready, for where she was going. And she wanted to get some news about a shark attack that's been all over the news here for a couple of days. And what she saw was a large tower spewing dark billows of smoke. Had she changed the channel? Some disaster movie? There was panic in the television voices. She sat at the foot of her bed and watched as a plane flew into the second tower setting a parallel to the first. Now it, too, looked like a gigantic smokestack. People were screaming and running for their lives. Maddie's heart began to race with them. This couldn't be true.
So. Powerful writing. We want to thank you both so much for being with us tonight. This has been delightful. And we want to thank everybody who was watching live or picking this up as a podcast on LA Talk Radio's Facebook page or YouTube channel or website. Next week, we're joined by Dr. Barbara Kotalska-Haskin, and we're going to be finding out How My Brain Works, A Guide to Understanding It Better and Keeping It Healthy. This is another author we've met through the Southwest Writers Group. And on behalf of Jim and me,
remember, it's always a great day
out west. Keep reading. Keep writing.
Thanks,
ladies. We'll see you next week.
We'll see you.
Bye.
You're listening to Rendezvous with the Writer with Bobby Jean and Jim Bell, only on LA Talk Radio.